Yeah, go ahead and jump right into it.
Okay. Well, you know, we got together at your place, what, 3 years ago?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. So, you know, Sir William must be up and about and really cranking it now, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's enjoying his terrible twos, let me tell you.
Oh, man. If you could figure out how to bottle that, you'd have it going on, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, let's see. I guess the best way to begin this is to say that, you know, right after the Berlin Wall came down in the early 90s, by virtue of one set of circumstances or another, a friend of mine who is a very bright scientist and has done some real innovative stuff over the years, was working as the chief scientist for a little privately owned technology development company down in Las Vegas called Ashurst Technology Corporation. By virtue of some purely accidental happenstance, one of the owners of Ashurst Technologies, a guy by the name of Benton Wilcoxon, happened to be in Switzerland on a long weekend. While he was, as the story goes, while he was out at a cafe having his breakfast, he overheard a conversation between some Russians and what appeared to be a very wealthy Italian guy, and they got into a big argument, and the Italian guy got up and got mad and threw his coffee cup down on the ground and stormed off. Well, Benton, by virtue of past experience, was a fluent Russian speaker. And he went over and introduced himself to those three guys and offered to buy their breakfast, and they had a conversation. And by the end of that day, he had learned about some technologies that they'd been developing at a secret institute in the Soviet Union called the I.N. Francevich Institute for Problems of Material Science. Next day, he got on an Aeroflot and flew to Kiev. And from Kiev, he went into the laboratories at the institute and discovered that this institute had not been known by the FBI or the Central Intelligence Agency or the Defense Intelligence Agency prior to the wall coming down, and they still had really no information about this place. They didn't have any idea what was going on in that. You'll recall in 1989 and 1990, early 91, the intelligence agencies were all over the former Soviet states ferreting out all of the technologies that had been developed there while the wall was up.
Right.
So Benton ended up inside the institute. He called his partner in Vegas, and he, you know, had him wire $100,000 into a Swiss bank account. This happened literally on the weekend when Gorbachev was abducted by the generals of the Red Army. And so it's a very interesting time, and a time of great uncertainty. They weren't really sure he was going to get back out of there in one piece. But ultimately what happened was that my friend Pete Peterson called me on the phone and asked me if I would come down to Las Vegas and work with him to do some strategic planning. I met with Benton Wilcoxon and his partners. The president of the company was a guy by the name of Bill Arrington. And I signed on with them, stayed with them for about a year. And my job there was to know everything there was to know about these new technologies and then figure out how to commercialize them. That was my job. So what ended up happening was that very shortly after this licensing and marketing agreement got put together between Ashurst and the Institute, Ashurst became the front door to IPMS. You couldn't get in there without going through the office in Las Vegas. And we contracted with the law firm of O'Melveny & Myers in Newport Beach, California, to bring in some engineers, Russian-speaking engineers and patent attorneys and technology specialists and scientists. Dr. Michael Melnikov from UCLA was there. He was the primary spokesman. And for about 6 months, we'd get up every morning at 5:30, get on an airplane, fly to Newport Beach, be in meetings all day long with these Russian-speaking Ukrainian scientists and engineers and technologists, having them demonstrate and explain these technologies. 5:30, 6 o'clock, we'd get on a plane, fly back to Las Vegas, go into the office, write down everything we could remember, get all the data into the computers, and then, you know, grab a few Z's and get up the next day and do it again. We did this for almost 6 months. And what we discovered was that at ITMS, during the 50 years that it had been in operation before the wall came down, the Soviet government, the Russian Academy of Sciences, had spent the equivalent of about $100 million to have the Institute meet its primary mission. And that mission, simply stated, was to know and understand everything there is to know about what makes nature work the way it does. No holds barred. They didn't get to decide what to do with their technology. That was up to somebody else. Their mission was simply to understand it. So these guys came up with 7 brand new sciences, 27 brand new technologies, and over 130 materials that we still don't have names for. We watched them bring them in. Many of these samples of technologies were brought in wooden ammo boxes, packed in Excelsior, sometimes packed in landmine containers. I mean, you never knew what these guys were going to bring into the meeting room, but, you know, they didn't have anything else to pack and carry them in. 2, 3, 4 at a time, we'd bring these guys into the conference room and have them set up their apparatus and demonstrate it and try to explain to us what it was and what it did and how it worked. And it was utterly mind-blowing stuff. For example, one of the technologies they developed was a methodology for converting lava rock, basalt, into weavable fibers.
Okay.
That technology is utterly and absolutely revolutionary, and it still has only very limited penetration into Western commercial markets. It's only now, 30 years later, that people are beginning to figure out what this stuff is worth and what to do with it. It was the material that formed the basis, for example, for the Soviet and Ukrainian lift body systems, which could throw so much more mass into space with such inferior fuels. Because what they did with the salt fiber was to mandrel wrap this stuff around casings and then spray metallic alloyed plasma onto the fiber in a continuous spray using robotic devices. Because the basalt has such a high melting point, they're able to spray plasmid metals onto the surface, momentarily soften the basalt, allow the metal to wrap itself around the fibers, and then everything all cooled together so that you now have a basalt fiber reinforced, perfectly alloyed, metallic material that forms one continuous, seamless fuel cell that can be recaptured and reused many, many times. Very strong, very light, impervious to the heat that is built up inside. They simply burned kerosene, mostly, in those days.
Right.
So, you know, that was one technology that came out of that application and out of the agreement. And so, you know, my experience with them was that I got to see all the technologies. I got to go to the institute. I got to meet the people. I got to speak with the technicians. I got to be present and read the materials and examine the stuff and talk with these people at great length, day after day after day, for almost a year. When Ashurst decided they were going to move to Canada, They wanted to put their stock on the Canadian Stock Exchange, and they took their technologies and went to Toronto and hooked up with MTech. And so my time with them ended. When I finished working with Ashurst, I then began writing a manuscript that talked about these technologies. I had a publisher, I had an agent, and, you know, wrote the 70-page publisher's treatment that had the sample chapters and the material and the yada yada. And I sent all that stuff to my agent. My agent was a woman named Leona Schechter. She and her husband, Jerry, had been in the White House press corps for nearly 20 years when I was working with her in 93 and 94.
Yeah, we actually know them here in D.C.
And they're very prominent people.
Yeah.
And, you know, aside from the fact that they're radical Democrats, still are rabid Democrats, Leona took my manuscript in her purse with her one day when she went to lunch at the press club.
Right.
And either by accident or by design, I've never found out, she ended up sitting with former Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci.
Okay.
She began asking him questions about some of the stuff that was in my manuscript, and he took her by the elbow and walked her out into the hall and said, "You're not supposed to know about this. All this stuff is classified. Where did you find out about this?" She said, "Well, one of my authors is writing a book." And I got it out of his manuscript.
Yeah.
I said, "You know, how about you give me a copy of the manuscript?" And she did.
Okay.
Basically sold my butt right down the river. 2 weeks later, while I was continuing to write this manuscript, the guy who was sponsoring the project was a good friend of mine, an attorney here in Salt Lake City, and he allowed me to write the manuscript in an office in his law office complex. And he was actually paying me a stipend so that I could pay my bills and pay my rent and keep the wheels on while I was doing this project, because he thought it was a great project. And one day, while I was, you know, about 2 weeks after this apparently happened between Leona and Mr. Carlucci, I ended up getting visited by two guys in dark suits with shaved heads and, you know, thin black ties. And they came into my office. They didn't identify themselves.
So I take it they were Mormons.
They didn't tell me who they were. They didn't give me any identification. They just started dismantling my computer.
Lovely.
So, you know, as luck would have it, I had just installed a new deadbolt on my office door, and it required a key from both sides. So, you know, they threw me out of my office. I locked it, and they couldn't get out. And I called the police and said that there was an assault and a theft in progress.
Right.
And so the police came and they arrested them. And they protested and they, you know, showed them ID and yada, yada, yada. And they still cuffed them and hauled them off and booked them. Well, about an hour later, I got a call from a guy who had been in and out of Ashurst all the time while I was working there. The guy from South Africa, who had been seconded, apparently, to the Defense Intelligence Agency. And by the time he called me, 3 years after I'd been in Las Vegas, he was then the regional director of the Defense in the Defense Intelligence Agency regional office in Gransbury, Texas. And so, you know, he called on the phone and told me flat out that I was not going to publish that book, that it was not going to happen. And I told them, you know, I'm an American. This is America. This stuff has not been classified. It doesn't belong to you. I didn't sign any national secrecy agreement. I didn't sign any non-disclosure agreement. I wasn't bound by any confidentiality prohibitions. And, you know, I'm going to write this book and I'm going to publish it. This off and die. I called my attorney, and they had a long conversation, and my friendly attorney took me for a walk in the park and helped me understand that unless I wanted my life to be a living hell from that moment forward, that we were going to have to make a deal.
Okay.
And ultimately what happened was that they debriefed me, They were astonished to find out that I knew everything about what they were worried about. I knew everything. And I have records. And I have computer disks. And they're all stashed away where people can't find them unless I want them to have them. And, you know, they threatened me. Next deal. They said that if I would agree not to publish the science as factual science for a period of 5 years, that they would then allow me to use the science in any fictional setting I wanted, which was no big help. And, you know, when I found out what went on, I called Leona on the phone, and she finally confessed, and she said, look, it was worth more to me to make a deal than it was to protect your manuscript. Get over it.
Wow.
So, you
I'll
know...
bring that up next time I see them.
All that information now, stuff that ought to be in the pipeline, in the world, all those technologies, the devices and the sciences that they developed, the techniques they developed, are all the technologies we need to solve the problems that we're facing, the global warming and everything else. They're fabulous technologies, and they are not in the world. I've kept track of the basalt fiber. We have a basalt fiber prototype project that we're working on.
Right.
And I have a source to get basalt fiber now, and they've agreed to provide it to us in virtually unlimited quantities to specification. But, you know, we're on the radar when we do that.
Yeah, I know.
We're on the radar when we do that. So it's, you know, it really is problematical. I mean, I've worked now for maybe 40 years to try to find ways to use the science and technology that's available to us to really address fundamental problems like treating nuclear waste and finding new ways to generate power without creating a waste stream and all of that stuff.
Yes.
Over the years, we've been reasonably successful. We've got some patents and we've got some prototypes and, you know, we've been trying to put the pieces together, but my history has been checkered by the fact that every time we get to within striking distance of really making something work, suddenly from some direction that I don't know about and can't predict and can't get out of the way of, our stuff goes away. I don't know whether that's because I'm utterly and completely incompetent or whether there's something else going on out there. I tend not to be a conspiracy theorist. I tend not to believe in all this paranoid stuff.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that I've got a long track record that I've done a pretty good job of documenting. And, you know, it's tough. So the last thing I want to say about this is that in my career, I've tried to be circumspect about what works and doesn't work. And in this last year, I finished writing a manuscript. Sometimes when I do presentations, Todd's heard me at some of my presentations talk about taking a page out of Ho Chi Minh's Guerrilla Warfare Handbook. Well, that book didn't exist until I wrote it. And the notion behind this manuscript is that this little guy who kicked butt on the mightiest army in the history of the world knew some things that we need to learn. Because when we create brand new technologies, especially when they're disruptive, particularly when they're baseline technologies, we're really issuing what is tantamount to a declaration of war. And we have seen and personally experienced the long, hard, sad events that happen when you do that without being aware of what you're really doing.
Right.
We've watched our friends be murdered and tortured and assassinated and disenfranchised.
We've
watched technologies being confiscated, impounded, classified, subject to national security orders. We've watched this happen for the last 40 years. People we all know are no longer alive because they got too close to the mark and they were killed. That's not paranoia, that's a fact.
Right.
So what I did was write a manuscript based on my personal experience that says, look, here are some rules of the road. If you're going to declare war, be smart about it. If you're going to spend money and time and energy and develop technologies, be informed about it. Decide how far you're willing to go. Make sure you know what you want and what you're willing to do to make it happen. And then take a page out of their book, because we know how they're going to behave.
Yeah.
Watch them. They're very consistent. They're totally predictable. All you have to do is pay attention. That manuscript is a strategic guide to managing innovation. That's what it's
for. What's the name of the manuscript?
It's called the Ho Chi Minh Guerrilla Warfare Handbook.
And it's available like on Amazon or...
I haven't published it yet. I still haven't written the last chapter. But you know, if any of the guys that we're working with decide that this would help them be informed about what they're doing, I'm happy to give it to them. I still have to finish writing the last chapter, but otherwise it's ready to go to the publisher.
Can you just post it on the internet?
Well, what I'd like to be able to do, Todd has worked very hard over the years trying to put pieces together and you know, drive these agendas. And, you know, if he's willing to make it available and wants to charge people $10 a piece for it, for an e-copy, I'll donate the $10 so he can start to recoup some of his costs. It's all copyrighted. I'm not worried about anybody violating my copyright. What I'm interested in doing is helping people avoid getting in trouble. Because the inventions that are being created now are needed, and we're working very hard to try to drive them. So anything we can do to help move the agenda forward in a productive and constructive, informative way, I'm willing to do.
All right, let's publish that puppy.
So, you know, if we can find a publisher, I'm almost done writing the last chapter. Let's get the damn thing published and get it going.
Well, there's a way anybody with an internet connection can upload a file. It's usually PDF. And then people, like via PayPal or credit card, buy an e-copy and then they download it because, you know, once the payment's processed, they get a link to download. And that link's usually good for, well, however long you want it to be, 24 hours or up to a week.
Sure.
And all that money would go directly to whatever account it designates.
Well, so, I'm happy to have you do that, partner. I mean, if we can find a publisher, let's publish it, but let's make it available. If you want me to send you a PDF of the manuscript, I can do that today.
Okay.
And, you know, put it on an FTP site someplace and use a PayPal account. And, you know, if people want to take a look at it, you know, you go ahead and use the money to recoup your costs.
That's the thing. There isn't any cost.
We can do some good.
That's the thing. There isn't any cost. You upload it to...
I'm not talking about current cost. I'm talking about the years that you've spent kicking ass trying to get stuff to work and spending lots of time and energy and money that you've never been reimbursed for.
Look who's talking.
Well,
I said, look who's talking.
I mean, come on, guys. Life is too short. I think it's a good piece of work. I think it's informative. I think it's constructive. I think it's an easy enough read, but it has some very specific tool sets that people can use if they want to get serious about doing something that works.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is that the technology is only about 15% of the equation.
Right.
The other 80% is all about crossing the minefield between the time you get your prototype to work to actually getting it into some commercial track that has some value. Okay. That gap is truly a minefield. And if you don't have a way to navigate that baby, you are not going to survive.
Who do you think?
All this tries to do is provide a way for people to be smart about it.
Yeah. What inventor researchers do you think are closest to the finish line with something in the advanced energy realm that you can talk about?
Well, we have a project now that we're working on. I sent you a picture of the device. We're working on a project that is really exciting because it really opens Pandora's box on the whole new energy equation. Over the years, people have used electrolytic devices to crack stoichiometric hydrogen off the water molecule. But few, if any, techniques have been developed that effectively do that without chemistry. Because what water is and what it does and how it really works has really not been understood universally at all. There are a lot of misconceptions and a lot of real wrong notions about what makes water behave the way it does. So we've built a device that uses a variety of different techniques that are proprietary. We can't talk about the techniques. What we can say is that this device cracks hydrogen off the water molecule without chemistry in a way that really is effective, and it's efficient, and it's scalable. And the way this Brown's gas comes off the device can be used in several different ways. The next step in our track is to harness the stream of gases by, for example, routing them directly through fuel cells. And we have a joint venture arrangement with a major supplier of fuel cells in negotiation now. They came in and looked at our device. And so, you know, we drive this gas directly into a fuel cell, produces electric power instantly. The greater the surface area of the fuel cell, that is, the more finely divided the filaments are, we can get down to carbon nanotubes, we're really talking, you know, serious surface area now, we'll be able to produce considerably more energy than it takes using our device to crack the hydrogen off and drive it through the fuel cells. We're not there yet. But we know we can get there because we understand the principles, and the principles are working. So we think we've done something that is important, because it means that in order for the hydrogen highway to really work, you've got to be able to produce hydrogen on demand in a way that's safe. You can't be hauling hydrogen around the back of your car in a tank. It's not going to happen. I don't care what GM says. The Vestra is just another EV1 PR deal.
Right.
But when you take that hydrogen tank out of the back of that chassis and you put a real-time, solid-state stoichiometric hydrogen generator that drives hydrogen on demand through fuel cells, and you've got a way to drive machines down the road very efficiently. The vapor that you leave is gas, or is water, and there are no other byproducts. It's just water, and it's very efficient. The unit we've built runs now at about 5 kilowatts, about 20 liters a minute in a conventional fuel cell device is going to give you the equivalent of about 5 kilowatts of power. With an appropriately structured battery bank, you now have the ability to use water to self-recharge your batteries and extend the range to about, well, let's see, At 20 liters of hydrogen gas per minute, Brown's gas per minute, you've got about 1,200 liters an hour. 1,200 liters an hour will double the fuel mileage of diesel number 2. So, you know, whatever your mileage would be with a conventional diesel engine, you can double that with this device. But if you're running on electric power with fuel cells, with a battery backup to carry the charge, you know, you ought to be able to extend the range of that vehicle to about 3,000 miles on 20 gallons of water. That's not bad.
No.
And it changes the equation. Fundamentally alters the equation. It's a baseline technology. It's fundamentally disruptive. The techniques that we're using are very proprietary. We've begged, borrowed, and stolen them from all the smartest people we can find with their permission. and we've got an apparatus, and it's built, and it works. So we think that makes a statement. We're then keeping a pretty low profile about all of this, and you know, so far we've been pretty successful with it.
Yeah,
but the fact of the matter is, we're not the only guys on the planet that are doing stuff like this.
Right.
I mean, it's like whack-a-mole. This stuff is popping up everywhere.
Exactly.
And it's wonderful. And so, you know, I mean, at some point in time, somebody's going to cross that margin and get their technology into the game in big enough numbers, fast enough, that it won't make any sense to kill people anymore. Because you can't stop it. It becomes irresistible.
Well, if you're available tomorrow night, if you listen to tomorrow night's roundtable from, well, really it starts at 5, but technically it's supposed to start at 6 p.m. Eastern, there will be a couple of folks on there you may want to listen in on and actually contact directly after they're finished with the roundtable.
One of the technologies we've been working on, Todd, that we're really excited about is, you know, we've been trying to figure out what happens really in a cold fusion cell. And it isn't fusion at all.
No, it's not.
It's not fusion at all.
But we
think we understand what it is.
Right.
And with that information, we've been in the process now of re-engineering what amounts to nothing less than a self-recharging capacitor.
Okay.
When you have a self... See, the Japanese use self-recharging capacitors to power all of their communications devices almost for the entirety of the Second World War. You don't see those devices in the world anymore at all. And there was a big conspiracy theory going on during the end of the war, when the Allies were recapturing the islands, they couldn't find any batteries. They thought the Japanese had figured out how to take all their batteries and 86 them or get them off the islands before the Americans could get in there and capture any of them. They didn't find any batteries. They didn't realize until much later that Dr. Iguchi's technology, the self-recharging ceramic capacitor, was what they'd been using for years to drive all their communications technologies. Well, that's exactly what's going on inside that cold fusion cell. And there is no more naturally capacitive material on the planet than palladium.
Right.
The fact that they've got it engineered so that it's in long, round rods in clusters inside a jar with foil covering the inside as an anode means that the electrons don't have a place to focus to exit. The thing that tipped us off about it was that we looked at the pictures of the pitting that had occurred inside the cell when the voltage discharges were erupting out of the sides of those palladium rods. And the literature, the proceedings that we looked at, suggested that the pitting in the foil was from neutron bombardment. Well, we've got pictures of neutron bombardment impact sites, and that ain't what it is at all.
No.
In a neutron bombardment pit looks like a rifle hole.
Right.
What they were showing was cratering. It
yeah.
looked like the surface of the moon.
Yeah, exactly.
And so after going through the numbers and looking at the pieces, I found photographs of other cratering sites that are absolutely identical. And that helped us understand that what's going on there is that you've now got high-density charge clusters coming off the sides of those capacitive palladium rods and impacting the surface of that foil. Well, that's a hugely important realization. When those charge clusters come off of there,
yeah.
they organize themselves, the electrons organize themselves into a torus. The torus has a definitive size. It's stable. It transports through that water and picks up protons because the basis of the fuel cell is the deuterium.
Right.
You've got heavy water in there. Well, it's picking up all these protons, and the protons are getting slammed into the foil, And there's enough mass there that when the electrons hit, they heat up, they melt the material, the protons cascade that material out into a crater formation, and then migrate into the material inside. And the pattern of it was fractal.
Okay.
So here you have the perfect example of a technology that worked in a way that was truly spectacular, but because the standard model is totally screwed up, everybody misinterpreted what it was. Well, they got a few neutrons now and again, and so they assumed it was fusion.
Right.
Well, the reason they got a few neutrons now and again, but never consistently, was because they were witnessing the evidence of self-organizing criticality in its quintessential form. Some of those charge clusters packed enough of a punch, often enough, to break apart the nuclei of some of that anode material, and when it did that, it released some neutrons. But that's what was going on. It wasn't fusion at all. But we've taken the basic information and re-engineered that doggone thing, and if you do it properly, you can take self-recharging capacitive devices. And they don't have to be made out of palladium. We make them out of aluminum and copper. Yes. We don't use heavy water. We don't need heavy water. What you want to do is drive those charge clusters into a mass and allow that mass to retain the heat. What you want is a buildup of thermal units, and you need mass to do it. And you got to have a continuous discharge of charge clusters to create the heat. But if you can have them be self-recharging, so you have no input source, then whatever heat you create gives you the ability to perform work. We've designed that device, and we're building it. Well, guys, if you've got a Freon engine, all you got to do is take it to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, and that baby will drive a turbine all day long. We can't use self-recharging capacitors to create 140 degrees Fahrenheit in some kind of thermal mass, then we ought to start doing something else. It's not cold fusion. It's Kenny Shoulder's high-density charge clusters at work.
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
Based on how you've seen things unfolding in the economy, how much time do we actually have left to get these technologies out?
I happen to think this is the greatest time in the history of the world to be doing this stuff. And the fact of the matter is, 5 years ago, there was so much intrinsic resistance to any of these kinds of innovative technologies that, you know, people were walking around wondering whether they were going to be able to survive the process. But in the last 48 months, we've seen the kind of disruptive cycle that is the perfect breeding ground for all of the best technologies we can create. There was never a time in the history of the modern world when there was more demand for energy and less resistance to innovation. It doesn't mean the bad guys are not out there. It doesn't mean they're not going to do whatever it takes to protect their territorial interests. What it does mean is that there's real money and real opportunity, and if you're smart enough and if you work together with good people, we have a far better chance now of making these things actually create traction in the commercial markets than we ever did before. The fact of the matter is that there's a lot of confusion in the economic markets, and there are plenty of places to hide. Everybody's talking about everything in terms of its greenness. I mean, it's begun to lose its meaning.
Right.
And that's just fine as far as I'm concerned, because what we're going to do is stay out of sight until we're ready to take a page out of Uncle Ho's guerrilla warfare handbook and pick our time and pick our ground and pick our strategy and drive it our way. There's never been a better time to do it, as far as I'm concerned. I think we've got all the time we need.
Okay. So, for those listening now, as well as, you know, the archive file when we upload it, what suggestions do you have for them in terms of actions they can take to support initiatives such as yours?
Like, it depends on which hat they're wearing, Todd. If they're inventors, you know, I plead with them to find a way to get smart about what you do. If the objective is to be on the Letterman show and get the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
But if the objective is to find a way to do something truly worthwhile that really works, then, you know, get a copy of the Ho Chi Minh book, put your skill sets together, ask the hard questions, be sure you're not believing your own press releases. The biggest teeth marks in my backside came because I did that. And, you know, you live and learn.
Yeah.
If you're people with money that are listening to this, remember this. We're going through the same economic cycle with exactly the same dynamics for precisely the same reasons that drove the dot-com crash in the late 80s and early 90s. Everybody that thinks they've got a great idea, who has a piece of PowerPoint presentation, who can tell a better story, has a good garage banter, got their 15-minute elevator pitch down to a science, those are the guys that are getting their hands on capital. And those are not the guys that are creating the technology that really works.
Yeah, that's the wrong.
The best technology is coming out of people's garages now. It's just like garage.com 20 years ago. The difference is that everybody's trying to cash in on this gravy train called green technology. And if you've got money to invest, the best thing you can do is find a way to validate whether or not the technologies that are being proposed to you actually work or not before you spend a nickel. Everybody's got a story. Inventors are consummate liars. We all have the tendency to exaggerate what our stuff will do so we can get the money, hoping that we'll be able to make it do that after we get our hands on it. That's why invention and this capital market that we live in is so subject to abuse.
Yeah.
Because people get themselves in so deep so fast that they have to do a Paul Pantone in order to get you to give your money to them, hoping beyond hope that they'll be able to find a way to make it perform so that they don't have to ask for more. It's a kind of addiction. And it's a dysfunctional behavior that taints everybody who's in the field trying to do real work that really is worth something. There aren't a lot of places you can go if you're in the capital markets to validate technology that is out there over the leading edge. And the guys that are in this stable of people that work with Todd, that work with Tom Vallone, that work with Mitchell Schwartz, that work with Bob Dratch, and the other guys that we're talking with, these guys are smart, they're well-informed, they're technologically competent, and you can go to them with your technology and pay them to help you figure out whether what you're thinking about investing in really works or not. If you invest your money without doing that, then you deserve it. You've got to be thorough and you've got to be careful. There are real technologies by truly brilliant, inspired people that are going to change the world, and they need your money. But you've got to be smart. You've got to be smarter than people who are glib. You've got to be smart enough to figure out what works and doesn't work and go to the trouble to find out.
Could I suggest to Phil Ryan and Kerry Cassidy tomorrow morning during the interview that they post your book on their website and do the PayPal thing through their website?
It's on you, Todd. Whatever works best for you is fine. Just go ahead on.
Okay. My goal is to get it to as many people as possible, so I prefer to just have it available for immediate download and then they could request donations.
Oh, that'd be fine with me.
Okay. I'll see what they think about it.
Fine with me.
If you,
you know, what I want to be able to do is, you know, find a publisher and get the damn thing published so that we can get it through Amazon and Barnes and Noble and whatever. But in the meantime, you know, let's do what works. Let's give people what they need and share what we know and find a way to move the agendas forward.
All right. Agreed.
That makes sense?
Sure does.
Whatever we can do, guys.
Okay. I'll follow up in an email tonight.
Okay. All right.
Go from
there. It was lovely to talk to you.
You too.
Kisses to the lovely Nora and give Sir William a hug for me.
All right.
All right,
I'll send you a picture.
All right. Well, do good, buddy. Let me know.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.